Well, drug use among athletes will certainly be one of the big stories of the Winter Olympics, which are just around the corner. Starting on February the 6th, NBC Universal will present 1,539-plus hours of coverage from Sochi, Russia, across multiple platforms, more than the previous two Winter Games combined, which got us thinking, why are we so fixated on the Olympics? In the words of author Stephen Amidon, no other figure is the focus of so much passion, controversy, expectation, and disappointment as the gifted athlete. Regardless of the game, watching the world's top competitors borders on the hypnotic. They appear to exceed physical limitations and become something like the gods. That is the name of the longtime sports lover and novelist Stephen Amidon's cultural history of the athlete. We spoke with him when the book first came out about the origins of the Olympic Games. The ancients regarded the athlete on a scale with the hunter and warrior. I asked Stephen how human survival played into the evolution of sport.
One of the earliest sporting events we know about that's recorded comes in the Iliad, in Homer's Iliad, where Achilles put on a funeral games for his friend Patroclus, who had been killed during the fighting at the Trojan War. And these games basically were indistinguishable from war. I mean, the events they contested were sword fighting, javelin throwing, discus throwing. And the connection between the warrior and the athlete at this time, which we believe is 1200 BC, 1100 BC, was absolute. What happened soon after that was that the Greeks started fighting wars differently. They started doing something, a soldier called a hoplite, which was basically a soldier with a huge shield who would march in formation towards the enemy. We know this from, you know, from B-movies from the 1950s.
Of course, and they all wore skirts.
Exactly. And so athletics kind of moved away from kind of part of a war towards an independent sort of event. And, of course, the ancient Olympics, which began in the 8th century B.C., were the premier example of this.
And they were held at Olympia, not as sometimes mistakenly attributed to Mount Olympus. But we don't really know why they began. What are some of the explanations?
Yes, I mean, the only event you could hold at Mount Olympus, which is in the north of Greece, would be ski jumping. none of the events we know could be held there. Olympia is a dusty place in kind of rural Greece, southwestern Greece in the Peloponnesian Peninsula. It's believed that the origin of the games there was that there was a temple to Zeus there. And the rumor was, or the legend was, I should say, was that Zeus and Cronos fought for the control of the universe there. So, you know, it was a grudge match, you know, it was a big event. And that also, you know, Apollo, Hercules, Ares, you know, would run races there. And so a temple was built and worshippers of Zeus would come there. And they would perform games to honor Zeus. And these evolved into the Olympics. There's also a legend that the king, the local king of this area, threw down a challenge that anyone who could beat him in a chariot race would win the hand of his daughter in marriage. Unfortunately, if you lost, you were killed. A lot of guys tried, a lot of guys died, until a clever fellow named Pelops came along and bribed the king's stable boy to sabotage the chariot. The king died in the race. Pelops not only got his bride, but also got the crown and became the great king Pelops of Peloponnesia.
So cheating and athleticism kind of combine in the early Olympics.
Well, you know, the Greeks, they played for real. I mean, they played for keeps. There were no silver medals in Greece. You know, you won or you were done. That was it. Greek culture was, you know, a zero-sum culture. And, you know, winning was extraordinarily important to the Greeks. And, you know, in their legends, if you read Greek mythology, if you read Ulysses, you know, in the Odyssey, you know, the idea of cheating was less clear cut to them than it might be to us. And really, you know, if you won, you know, there was a real tendency on the part of the Greek fan to forgive whatever you did to get that done.
How about the spectators? How much of a draw were these early games for the Greek audience?
It was huge. I mean, and it was a very difficult trip to get there. People came from all over the Greek Empire. There wasn't a truce to wars at the time, but there was. That's a legend. That's not really true. But there was safe passage every 4 years, given to Olympia, and it was the place to be. People rolled out from Athens, in particular. Great playwrights, Aeschylus, Sophocles, would premiere works there. Athenian prostitutes could make, you know, double their year's wages just being there. It really became like the world's first great tailgate party. And there were, you know, rich Athenians would throw lavish parties. They'd have hospitality tents, so to speak. And it really was the great event in the Greek calendar.
What were some of the events featured in the early Olympics?
The first event was something called the Stadion. And so the first Olympics were actually just a 210-yard race called the Stadion, and that was it. And the first one was won, we believe, by a lowly cook named Koroibos won that. But gradually, or soon after, the events were added on, discus, javelin, longer races, things like that. The most popular events, besides the foot races, were something called the Pankration, which was basically a kind of an early form of mixed martial arts. It was just a no-holds-barred wrestling, and chariot racing. The chariot racing was hugely popular, kind of a precursor to NASCAR, and people did indeed come for the wrecks. Homer once described a shipwreck of chariots at one of these races.
Let's talk about some of these other famous athletes. I was particularly taken with Milo of Croton from 6th century BC.
Yes, Milo was the greatest athlete of the ancient Greece, and he was quite a character. He as a boy, this is all legend, of course, but as a boy, he used to bench press baby bulls to get in shape. And he won, I think, 6 Olympic titles in a row. So over a 24-year period, he was the master wrestler of Greece. He once, by legend, walked into the ring carrying a lamb over his shoulders, slaughtered the lamb, cooked it, ate it, and then turned to his opponent and said, "Let's fight." Evidently, his opponent was not really game for that. Milo also became hugely rich. Some historians now think he made as much as $30 or $40 million in the course of his lifetime. Mm. You know, that's Peyton Manning money. And his death came when he was wandering through the woods and he saw a woodsman was trying to split a tree, and he couldn't using a wedge. And so Milo tried to do it with his hands. The tree snapped back, caught his hands. The woodsman was terrified, took off, and Milo was devoured by wolves that night. That death in his life led to he became a demigod. People 500-600 years later were still coming to his temple to worship him. He was sort of the Hercules of real athletes.
Your book, of course, is about the evolution of this heroism, the demigod status, the physical and moral and ethical failings also of the mere human athlete and the seemingly hypnotic hold that they have over us. Do you think this is something, looking back, is ingrained in us as humans, or is this a cultural phenomenon?
I think researching this book and thinking about my own thoughts about sports and the athlete, I think it's ingrained to us. I think athletes, we see them as representing something kind of special in us, and it's so palpable, it's so visual, it's so present, and that we really use athletic performance as a sort of mini theater.
Stephen Amidon there on the origins of the Olympic Games and our near deification of the athlete. His book on the subject is called Something Like the Gods, a cultural history of the athlete from Achilles to LeBron. Stephen's currently at work on his 7th novel. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Maybe you're familiar with the TED Talk slogan, Ideas Worth Spreading. Up next, we're going to speak with a TED Talker who dared to ask the question, are the ideas presented at TED really worth spreading? That's when Word of Mouth continues.